Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon into understandable terms for regular folks. Our goal is to build understanding about the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my colleague, friend, and co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And today, we're launching a multi-part series on the U.S. Supreme Court's most recent decision on presidential immunity. We're going to examine the explosive impact of the decision, decode its multiple parts, and try to predict its impact on current cases pending against former President Donald Trump. We also, in a later episode, will be talking with a psychiatrist about the overall impact of the decision on the American psyche. So let's get started. Gail, you ready?
I am ready.
All right. Let's talk about the decision that came out last Monday. It's taken us a week to sort of synthesize it and feel it. It was a 6-3 vote by the United States Supreme Court. They granted absolute immunity for the president for constitutional acts, presumptive immunity for other acts, tried to define some unofficial acts, and talked about evidentiary questions involved. It was a very complex decision. We're going to try to break that down for you. We have the majority decision. Then we have two concurring opinions, one by Justice Amy Coney Barrett and one by Justice Clarence Thomas. Concurring opinion is when a justice agrees with the outcome of the case, but perhaps for different reasons, or agrees with the bulk of the outcome of the case, but maybe doesn't agree totally with one particular reason. It doesn't change the vote. It's still a 6-3 vote, but it explains their position. And we'll get into Judge Coney Barrett's analysis that really was questioned some of the court's rationale. Justice Clarence Thomas went off on a total different track, and we'll talk about that later too. There were also two dissenting opinions. Now, a dissenting opinion is when a justice or a group of justices disagree with the majority opinion. It is their minority opinion. It has no force of law, but it expresses their disagreement with the majority. And sometimes those dissenting opinions are used in future cases to change a court precedent. In this case, we had two dissenting opinions. Justice Sotomayor wrote a very strong dissenting opinion. It was joined by Justice Kagan and Justice Brown Jackson. And Justice Brown Jackson also wrote a dissenting opinion of her own. We're going to try to get through all of that, and let's get started. So this decision, Gail, you and I have been struggling with it because it is so monumental. Let's talk a little bit about the emotions first. The breadth of this decision went beyond even what former President Trump's attorneys asked for.
I think that's even what Justice Sotomayor said.
It changes everything in this situation. With presidential immunity, it changes actually the structure of our government. And you and I are having some difficulty with that.
Absolutely. And I believe in large part, at least for me, the difficulty is because of how we have always known, perceived, and responded to the role of the court. And in relying upon the court to provide this type of very, very, very important guidance, the opinion itself or the decision of the court, at least in my view, seems to completely reshape the contours of the Constitution by providing a shield for a former president and shielding them from essentially ever being required to answer for criminal or treasonous behavior. And I believe those were even the terms that Justice Sotomayor used because of just the way that it's crafted and how the majority found justification for that. And it really does leave me a bit challenged when I think about how a functioning democracy is supposed to continue to function in light of the now superpowers seemingly vested in the office of the presidency.
The opinion was so strong that many believe, and I am one that believe, I believe this, that it has changed our democracy to what's called an autocracy or a monarchy, where the chief executive, the president of the United States, can do no wrong. All power is vested in that person and cannot, in certain situations, be challenged by Congress or by the courts or by anyone. And that is so drastic that, a week later, I'm still reeling from it.
Mm-hmm.
So let's look at the decision a little bit, if we could, Judge Gale. The way I want to try to fashion this so that people can understand it is that we have four buckets. There are four different parts of the decision. There's an absolute immunity bucket. There is a presumptive immunity bucket. There is an unofficial acts bucket. And then there is an evidentiary question bucket. Those are the four buckets. So I want to try to go through bucket by bucket and see how we can explain this to people. The court said in the majority opinion that there are some acts of the president that are absolutely immune from ever being criminally prosecuted. Absolutely immune. And that's anything that the Constitution mandates for the president to do. Constitutional mandates, absolutely immune. Now, what are those? Well, making treaties, vetoing and signing bills, representing our nation with foreign governments, acting as the commander in chief. That's key. We'll circle back. Calling out troops to protect our country against attacks, making suggestions of new laws, leading his or her political party, granting pardons, nominating cabinet members, selecting nominees to the Supreme Court, and any communications with executive branch departments and leaders, the court put under this umbrella of constitutionally mandated official acts. Now, that may sound okay on its surface. Just think about it a moment. You think, okay, constitutional acts. Maybe the president ought to be immune from that. But let's look at an example where perhaps the president calls on the military to assassinate a political rival. Far-fetched?
Not at all.
Maybe not. So the president would be immune from that. As illegal and as immoral as we think it might be, the president could suffer no legal consequence for that. But what about the soldier or the team of soldiers that would carry out that assassination? They may be liable, but the president would be absolved.
And Tom, if I can hop in for a quick second on that point. And just say, consider the fact that if the president, under this ruling, the president would be immune both while in office and even after leaving office.
Total
for
immunity.
That same act. So
total immunity.
What needs to be understood is that there is no option for delayed prosecution, that the act took place while he was in the office of the presidency, and that essentially provides cover both while in office and forever after leaving office, even if it was for something just as you described, which is calling up the military for the exclusive purpose of targeting, harming, assassinating your political rival or rivals.
And let's take another example. What if the president decided that he or she would refuse to leave office after losing an election and call out the military to keep them in office? Immune, according to the Supreme Court decision. The president could do that. So if that's the case, where are we in the sense of democracy here?
Indeed, you could really face presumably a situation where there would be no more presidential elections if you had someone refusing to leave office, notwithstanding the outcome of any democratic election, right? Or voting process. It does not matter. The outcome doesn't matter if the person is vested with the authority to not leave office.
Specifically, in this case, the Supreme Court has already ruled on the January 6th case, the one that Special Counsel Smith, Jack Smith, has in Washington, D.C., in front of Judge Chutkan. The Supreme Court has already ruled that conversations between President Trump and the Department of Justice trying to get them to go along with his plot to stay in office and overthrow the election, those were official acts under the Constitution because the president can order actions by the Department of Justice. That seems far-fetched to me, but that was specific in the ruling, was it not?
Absolutely. And as a former prosecutor, it actually felt pretty stunning because prosecutors are required to follow the law. And under a circumstance like this, it just seems so challenging to kind of wrap your head around the idea that the president could use their power to change essentially the mission of the Department of Justice, remember the title, Department of Justice, to achieve a personal end or a personal goal that is antithetical to the ends of democracy. That to me that's amazing. But you're absolutely right. That was the specific language inside the opinion itself, which essentially says, listen, the president has the authority to essentially decide the path and the cases and how the Department of Justice will conduct itself. And this behavior was not outside those bounds. I would have thought from my own experience that it would have clearly been outside the bounds of what the Department of Justice was ever designed to do. But apparently the Supreme Court, the majority of the justices on the U.S. Supreme Court did not agree with that.
No, they did not. And let's just take this a step further. You, as a former prosecutor, if I read the Supreme Court decision accurately, the President of the United States could order the Justice Department to investigate and indict any political foe, any enemy, political enemy, anybody who is disloyal to the president, anybody who objects to a policy of the president, could be subject, upon order of the president, to investigation and indictment, and the president would be absolutely absolved and immune from any prosecution for that.
Now, that's really chilling. But that is, you know, presumably what absolutely could happen. Now, I'll go as far as to say now, you know, I think there are some who would agree with me that the Department of Justice, without regard to administrations, have, you know, engaged in what they, you know, feel are, you know, just completely baseless investigations that may not have resulted in formal charges being brought or indictment. But remember, you know, you've got prosecutors, you know, whether they're state, federal, or local, who often have to combat that presumption that you can indict a ham sandwich. And if that's the case, then the president of the United States would be, you know, in, I guess, in the sandwich making business, because he could have ham sandwiches indicted left and right for any and everyone that he, you know, has an axe to grind with, or a score to settle with, or someone he does not, or she, he or she does not agree with. This could be a really, really suppressive tool, because the threat of, you know, investigation, indictment, of incarceration, because that's the path that's normally thought of when thinking of the Department of Justice. This is exactly what creates that chilling effect. This is what will create people, you know, in an entire environment in a society where folks will be now not so free, or not feel as free to speak freely, to act freely, to express themselves. So it almost guts all of those other rights that are embedded inside the Constitution itself, without directly saying as much, for fear that that will absolutely, in acting in any of those ways, the outcome will absolutely result in loss of freedom, loss of work, you know, loss of enjoyment of life, all of those things. When you're under investigation, or if you're facing a federal indictment, and these are the resources that are being used against you because for whatever reason, the president of the United States or his allies or friends are upset with you, they could use these tools against you. It can really upend your life. And that could be just absolutely torturous for just any average everyday American who just feels like, you know, they aren't even in the inner circle. If they just happen to, if you are, imagine being a TikToker, right? Imagine Facebooker or someone, or a YouTuber.
Anybody who
right?
says anything publicly.
Right. Imagine having a YouTube channel that's pretty popular and people visit, and you just happen to say the wrong or the thing that someone in the White House doesn't agree with on that particular day. Your entire life could be upended because you use that platform to say whatever you felt. And even though free speech is guaranteed under the U.S. Constitution, it now has to be balanced against the fact that you have a supreme authority in the White House who has levers and tools that you don't have, and can at any time call upon those levers and tools against you because you're exercising that right that is guaranteed in the Constitution, but might as well be limited because it's now chilled for fear of retribution on any given day. That is, again, that's not a democracy anymore. That is exactly what you described.
Let's take this one step further, and then I want to go on to bucket number two. Recently, the former President Donald Trump has indicated that he would not be adverse and, in fact, might promote military tribunals, televised military tribunals, to investigate and to try Liz Cheney for treason for what she did with the January 6th committee. Now, that sounds outrageous. But under this decision, Trump versus the United States, issued last week, he could do that and not fear any legal reprisal.
And not to mention, he could do that to the detriment of his target. In this instance, it would be former Representative Cheney or former Congresswoman Cheney, who would then and could then face whatever penalties are meted out as a result of that tribunal exercise. I'm not certain, you know, how much folks will have faith in his fairness, but that exercise, that very public exercise. And even knowing that the motive or the intent behind it is really to seek retribution for her participation on the January 6th committee, he would do that knowing that he would never face any penalties, any criminal penalties. And I want to put a pin in that for a second, because if you'll recall, during the January 6th hearings, and this is the second impeachment effort, there were great strides taken by some members in elected office, particularly in the Senate, who justified their vote or their position to not impeach the former president because they rested in this comfort that he could be criminally prosecuted. So impeachment wasn't a requirement or precursor to criminal prosecution, and therefore they were not required, even if they agreed with the outcome of the investigation, and even if they believed all of the witnesses and all of the evidence that was put forward, they did not have to vote to impeach the president because there was a criminal justice system firmly intact and in place that would be able to criminally respond to this behavior. And this opinion essentially says, ha ha, not so
fast. Not anymore. Not anymore.
No, it doesn't exist. That's stunning.
So that's the absolute immunity that some people on its face may think, oh, that's good. I hope that now you've heard some of the problems with that part of the decision. But let's move on to the second bucket that we want to talk about, and that's presumptive immunity. And here we're talking about not constitutional acts of the president, but acts of the president that are what are called discretionary responsibilities. And the court said these are what are called the outer perimeter nature of official acts, whatever that means. Outer perimeter, that's the words used by the court, of official acts. They're not constitutional, but they're other acts. Now, what the court said, and I want to read you a quote here in a moment, but what the court said was that we're not going to give those non-constitutional outer perimeter acts absolute immunity, but we're going to give them presumptive immunity. Now, what does that mean? That means that all the acts of the president, all the official acts of the president, whether they're constitutional or otherwise, are presumed to have immunity. So the quote I wanted to read was, this was from the Chief Justice Roberts' opinion. but the breadth of the president's discretionary responsibilities under the Constitution and the laws of the United States frequently makes it difficult to determine which of his innumerable functions encompassed a particular action. The immunity of the court that the court has recognized, therefore, extends to the outer perimeter of the president's official responsibilities, covering actions so long as they are, here's the heart of the quote, not manifestly or palpably beyond his authority. Not manifestly or palpably beyond his authority. So, because these actions are presumed to be immune, to get them to not be immune, a prosecutor has to have an evidentiary hearing before a trial judge to convince the trial judge that the actions of the president were not were one, manifestly, whatever that means, or two, palpably beyond his authority. Have you ever heard those terms before in legal parlance?
You know, I am not aware of those terms being used in any requirement for legal application. This is all new. I think just even the creation of this standard or this requirement is kind of whole cloth. And that I don't know that we can point to anything similar to it before. And leaving it to the trial judge to make a determination, and I kind of chuckle because it's just that challenging, because to leave it to the trial judge to decide if something is manifestly or palpably beyond their authority without any other guidance. Because the guidance that courts receive.
That's all it said.
That's all it is. There's nothing. There is no definition of manifestly. So should the judge rely upon, common definitions in, in Webster's dictionary? Should they refer to Black's Law Dictionary? Should they rely on their own personal opinion, definition, or interpretation of the term?
I bet you would never find the term palpably in a law dictionary.
Exactly. And generally, again, these definitions are provided by the legislature and the court interprets and applies them then. There's nothing here. And given, I think, the way in which this opinion was kind of created and framed, it's like more booby traps in a sense, because the trial judge may, in fact, make a well-reasoned determination that, maybe an act was manifestly or palpably within the former president's authority or was not. It certainly leaves the door open to whichever side is unhappy to then appeal their application of the definition or appeal their application of the use of the term in that specific instance, such that you will have litigation ad nauseum. You will never get to, it seems like getting to the end of the road, getting to final resolution is always going to be elusive because you're likely not going to get there. What's more is the evidentiary hearing, the hearing that the trial judge has to have when
it's going to be a nightmare.
Yes, it is going to require testimony, maybe the presentation of evidence, but then again, as we talk more, we'll talk more about the limitations.
It's a trial before the trial.
Exactly. It really is the pre-trial. It's the literal definition of a pre-trial. And
well, Judge Gale,
that's going to invite recusals.
Right. Let me just add one more thing on this. And this is also from the opinion of the court in this second category of outer perimeter official acts. It says, at a minimum, the president must be immune from prosecution for an official act unless the government can show that applying a criminal prohibition to that act would pose no, quote, dangers of intrusion on the authority and functions of the executive branch. What the hell does that mean?
You know what? I have no idea, but in my mind, I was thinking, why did we even bother calling it the executive branch? Why don't we strike that and just write king?
Or monarchy.
Or the monarchy, yes. Because if you read it and substitute that word, it actually sounds, at least in my humble opinion, it sounds more consistent with exactly what the opinion achieved, which was, yeah, untouchable. It is, if you play Monopoly, folks, this is like starting the game with a get out of jail free card, playing the game, never having to surrender that card, no matter how many times you perhaps rightfully should have gone to jail, and ending the game with the get out of jail free card so that you can use even after the game is over. And if you were ever to come back, it does not matter. In fact, you just have a revolving door of get out of jail free for any and just about everything. And by what you said, Tom, the burden rests with the prosecution, meaning the responsibility or obligation to prove these acts being with, you know, being not manifestly or palpably in that authority.
Not by a preponderance of the evidence, not by proof beyond a reasonable doubt, not by clear and convincing, but you have to prove it so not manifestly or palpably. You know,
like what standard is that? A new standard of proof?
that's what it seems like. So the prosecution has this burden, and that moves us to bucket number three. The court, I think reluctantly, but that's my interpretation, said, yes, there are some actions that a president might take that are unofficial acts. And for those unofficial acts, we're going to say that the president is not immune, that the president could be subject for criminal liability. However, we're going to make the trial judge, whether it's state or federal, make a determination after this evidentiary hearing that we just talked about, whether the action is an official act or an unofficial act. Now, I think four or five times in the decision, they said, we're sending it back to the trial judge. We're a court of review. We're not a court of first instance, which means we're not going to make the initial decision. We'll send it back to you, trial judges. You make the decision, but we're not going to give you guidelines of what that decision's going to be or how to make that decision. You're sort of on your own. Read our opinion and interpret it as you will, and make those decisions on your own without a lot of guidance. Then the decision went on to say, but we're going to tell you some things about how we feel about this. First of all, as we said, your discussions, Mr. President, with the Justice Department, those are totally absolved, totally immune. Let's talk about public statements, or if you talk to a state official, or if you talk to the vice president about his duties in certifying an election. Is that an official act or a private act? Well, we're going to leave that up to the trial courts to decide that. You know, presidents speak a lot of times, and they speak mostly publicly. But I guess as a candidate or leader of a party, they could speak privately. But we don't know. Trial judges, you make that decision.
And judge, I promise you, this is going to be the trial judge makes the decision, issues a well-reasoned opinion, and the court's going to, you know, likely say, well, that wasn't really what we had in mind when we said that.
Yeah. Never mind. You know, mm-hmm. Good work.
Nice try.
Nice try, as this has taken 2 years to get back to that point. You know, because all of this means delay. All of this means delay. You know, these matters will not be resolved probably for 5-10 years, if then.
Yeah. And the hope is that by the time it is, there's a whole nother generation who will either be, you know, completely unable to do anything about anything, or that people would have forgotten or they don't care. Apathy is often a really good antidote to situations like this. If you can just make people apathetic or distracted or immersed in other things, we can really, you know, dampen the importance or lessen the importance of this.
So you read the decision. I read the decision. They talk about public statements. They were really talking about the January 6th speech that the president made. And the court inferred that that was an official act that would be subject to at least that perimeter or that presumptive immunity for a perimeter act. But what about tweets of a president? At what point are they official and at what point are they personal? There were no guidelines given to the trial court to make those decisions.
And remember, you know, one of the reasons I believe behind creating kind of the official handles, if you will, Twitter handles or the like for the office of the presidency is to distinguish between those statements made in the personal capacity versus those that would be made speaking on behalf of the office, because the presumption is that in a functioning democracy, the individual who is holding the office will not always hold the office. So that handle, that POTUS handle or FLOTUS handle would pass from one individual to another. Why? Because it is not something that is necessarily connected to the person as much as it is to the office. But this really does kind of blur the lines of, okay, if you use, you know, either your personal identifier or the office designated identifier on any of these social media outlets, are those protected and are those considered part of your official acts and duties?
I don't know. That's my answer. I don't know. The court had, let me give you one more quote on this topic. This is a quote: whether communication alleged in the indictment, and this was the January 6th indictment, involve official conduct may depend on the content and context of each. This necessarily fact-bound analysis is best performed initially by the district court, which defines trial court. So what does that say? Content and context. We're going to go through each tweet. We're going to go through, have an evidentiary hearing on the context and content of each tweet, each statement, each speech.
And this is before the trial itself would begin, because it would necessarily need to be
to determine whether we could even have a trial.
Right. And what evidence can be used or presented at trial. Absolutely. It could really hamper an entire prosecution, whereas before we, you know, kind of never seen these kinds of limitations placed on the prosecution of cases. Quite frankly, you don't see these limitations placed on the prosecution of any other types of presumably criminal acts. Prosecutors do not have to undertake these exercises. And I realize that, you know, for official presidential acts, there should be more scrutiny. And I don't disagree with the higher kind of level of scrutiny for official acts, because we want our presidents to be able to do the job that we have elected them to do without the burden or concern of criminal prosecution as a result of that. However, it's the additional steps that the court took in defining these or identifying, I won't say defining, because they left so many questions unanswered that I think it creates more of an issue and a challenge, even for trial courts, than maybe they had even thought about or intended, because there are way too many unanswered questions and they've not even provided appropriate guidance. And what it does is it invites trial court judges to make determinations and decisions on important evidentiary issues before the trial can even start. These become, I would presume, they would then become ripe for what's called an interlocutory appeal, which is an appeal in the middle of the case. Because if you have these evidentiary hearings, you don't like the ruling of the court, you believe it goes against the Supreme Court's opinion, then you're going to do everything you can to halt either the continuation of the actual trial or even starting the actual trial until you've gotten an answer on that, which goes to that whole 10-year time frame that you just outlined, Tom.
All right. Let's move on to what I think is the most disastrous part of this opinion, if we haven't talked about disaster already.
But wait, there's more.
Wait, there's more. There's the fourth bucket, and that's the bucket we call the evidence bucket, or the evidentiary bucket. The court went on to say that if the trial judge determines that something is an unofficial act by the president and subject to potential criminal liability, that if a prosecutor prosecutes that case, the prosecutor cannot use any evidence of any sort, testimony, phone logs, data, anything, during the time of the official act that brought about that unofficial act. Now, that gets real confusing. I know it's confusing. Let me try to break it down. I think Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who disagreed with this part of the decision, made it a good point. She said, her hypothetical was the President of the United States grants a pardon to someone, but does it because he's going to get money in return, a bribe. He's granting a pardon for money. The court and Justice Amy Coney Barrett says that the bribe, receiving the money, is an unofficial act subject to criminal prosecution. But the Supreme Court's decision says you can't go back and look at the motives of the president in talking about that bribe, any of his communication about that bribe before he issued the pardon. You can't look at his motives for issuing the pardon. You can't consider any of that as evidence. Now, to me, that totally guts any possibility of going forward with prosecution, even on unofficial acts. What's your opinion?
I do. I think it, if it doesn't gut it completely, it erects so many barriers to effectively prosecuting a case that it makes it almost impossible to effectively do so. Now, let's start with the premise that motive is not a required element of proof in criminal cases. So I would often say when I was prosecuting a case, hey, listen, this is what we have, and I don't have to prove motive. I don't have to prove the why. But here's what we know, and here's what I always knew, is even though I didn't have to prove the why, that the decision maker, whether it was the judge and it was a bench trial, or if it was a jury and it was 12 citizens trying to make a determination on this case, they still wanted and in many respects needed to understand the motive in order to make the case make sense to them. It is unreasonable to think that you can't.
It's leaving out the main part of the story. What's
exactly
the reason?
The why? It's like, again, it's like having a murdering heir or somebody who's going to inherit a really big insurance payday if their loved one passes away. All of a sudden, 3 months after the insurance is increased double, and they pay, the loved one passes away, you can't tell the jury anything other than they were married, they had insurance, and somebody died.
And the person got paid.
Yeah,
you couldn't go back to communications with the hitman.
Nope.
You couldn't go back with any of the bank withdrawals to pay the hitman. You couldn't go back to any of the phone records with the insurance company.
Or bank
any
records.
Any of the emails. None of that. It's married, dead, insurance paid. Crime.
And you guys figure it out.
Good luck with that. Yeah. How are you ever going to prove it? So the Chief Justice retorted in a footnote to didn't like being challenged by one of his conservative throng here. And he said the prosecutors could tell the story that a president had taken an official act that led to an unofficial criminal act, but could not present documents or testimony asking the jury to scrutinize the president's motivation. So,
wow. But meanwhile, the burden of proof doesn't change. The burden of proof is still beyond a reasonable doubt, wherein that kind of evidence is absolutely important and necessary to actually achieve satisfaction of the high burden of proof.
Yeah, and what that means also is that you can't look at any motivation, none whatsoever.
Nope.
He's saying you can tell the jury that the pardon was granted, and you can tell the jury that the president got money. That's it.
And everything in between is,
it's on that outer perimeter of official acts. I think this evidentiary ruling really negates any kind of argument against immunity. I mean, it grants immunity across the board, even for unofficial acts, because as a prosecutor, how difficult it would be to prove a case without being able to show background and or motive.
Exactly. It would be, again, I won't say it's impossible, because depending upon the kind of evidence you might have, there may be some glimmer of hope. But this is, I think, what it meant when there were so many analysts and so many scholars who said, well, this went beyond even what had been asked for as part of the original filing in the original case. This took it even further. And essentially, if this isn't slamming the door, I mean, okay, so maybe they didn't weld the door shut, but they definitely closed the door on the prosecution. And maybe the prosecution could turn the knob and open it a little and maybe proceed. But if they do, it makes also, again, satisfying that burden of proof in a criminal case beyond a reasonable doubt. And we talked about what those different burdens of proof require in order to be successful. Without that important element or information related to motive, again, even though it's not a specific element that requires proof, we all know that in reality, we're beyond theory. In reality, it is absolutely necessary and quintessential.
Jumping then to the concurring opinion of Clarence Thomas, not only did he agree with all the things that we talked about, the four buckets, but he added a fifth only for him. His whole concurring opinion was how the appointment of Jack Smith as special prosecutor was unconstitutional. and pretty much laid out a blueprint for Judge Eileen Kelly or
Cannon.
Cannon, I'm sorry, in Florida to rule accordingly. It was bizarre.
And that too, and we've seen kind of those whistles, if you will, before, kind of saying, hey, bring
this
us
isn't
this
a
case.
Dog whistle. This is a factory whistle.
A bullhorn. It's like swallowing a bullhorn. But again, I think there are those who would have said that the court often signals, if you will, on how they might rule or what they might want to see or what they might want to weigh in on. And they've done that before. I mean, trust me, you know, the Dobbs decision was not an accident. It wasn't happenstance. It was very strategic, as was this current case opinion. And, you know, it also how the case with the documents is being handled. The thing of that is just what's so interesting is, and I don't think that the court really address this very specific issue, again, except that they've provided this issue of immunity post-presidency. So we recognize that there can only be one president at a time. The behavior of former President Trump, as alleged in the Florida case, the documents case, is that this all took place after his presidency had ended and after the National Archives had several times requested the return of documents for which he had no legal authority to continue to hold on to. And so that's part of the cases. Now, I won't say that that is the whole case in sum and total, but there's only one president at a time. And so if you're looking at this, it would seem that the opinion, you know, even inoculates that behavior, right? And whereas he otherwise, you know, you're retaining or you're holding these documents while you are no longer the president, the opinion goes the step further to say, okay, if this had been an official act while you were president, you certainly would have been immune. But even though you weren't president anymore, we can create these carve-outs that will continue to shield or provide protection even after you have departed the position. And I don't think, again, I don't think that's what the framers intended when the country was born and the Constitution was crafted. And quite frankly, even for those who are, you know, who are the most supportive personally, because this is sometimes people get, you know, personal and legal positions kind of mixed up. For those who personally support Mr. Trump, I think at the end of the day, we all agree that we all live in a country where we expect to all be held by the same standard, no matter what. If that's the case, I mean, should we expect that there will be a different standard for billionaires or millionaires? Or is there a billionaire standard in the justice system? Is there a millionaire standard in the justice system? Is there a pauper or poor people's standard in the justice system? Because again, these are positions that folks are expecting, that everybody, these are rules everybody's expecting to be governed by. And to hear or to learn that one person in particular may not ever have to face this or won't ever have to face this, not may not, with the pronouncement of this, they won't unless or until Congress acts and changes something or seeks to impose a new amendment. This is now the reality. And will it now also invite others who may not be fit or prepared or appropriate for this level of public office, but now sees the carrot, and it's a heck of a carrot being dangled? Does that encourage them to now say, well, look, you know what? This is what I need to do. I mean, do we now relax all of our requirements for the highest office in the land and any and everyone can run for it without us holding them accountable? Because that can be a heck of a motivation to run for a president is, my gosh, I will never be accountable for anything ever again.
Yep. In our last minutes, I agree with you 100%. In our last minutes, I do want to talk about the dissent. Justice Sotomayor had a 29-page dissent calling the majority's decision a threat to democracy with, quote, disastrous consequences, end quote. She said it makes a mockery of the principle that no one is above the law. And she also said the relationship between the president and the people he serves has shifted irrevocably. Mm-hmm. In every use of official power, the president is now above the law. And she ended her dissent with the quote, "For fear for our democracy, I dissent." Strong words.
Absolutely. And what's interesting is, so the opinion itself and the dissent is all driven and is governed by this very specific case. I don't know that I saw the court actually address the case itself with specificity.
Yeah, it did. It went through several aspects of the indictment, but then had a catch-all comment. Judge Chuck, can you take care of the rest?
Right. And now Judge Chuck can handle all of this and then get back to us, and we'll let you know if this is what we were thinking. But it's probably not. You can probably bet that it's whatever you come up with is probably not what we were thinking. And even in all of this, again, whether the next president in November is the current president of President Joe Biden or it is the former president, Donald Trump, these are the rules that we have now been saddled with regard to either of them. Now, I realize there's a certain benefit that absolutely inures to former President Trump as a result of this, but there's still the potential that he may not be the winner in November, which would then just, you know, essentially has crowned President Biden as king, even though he does not act or respond, he does not act or respond to the rule of law the same way that former President Trump does. And that is, I think, the thing that may scare some people or may unnerve them. But there's no guarantee of the November election outcome. But in either instance, one or the other will be king.
That's right. You're absolutely right. And
both of that, those ideas are offensive to democracy.
How distressing is that? One final dissent, and that is Justice Brown Jackson, who joined in Sotomayor's dissent, but also issued her own. And she really had a quote in here that I want to get your reaction to, Judge Gale. She said, "The majority of my colleagues seem to have put their trust in our court's ability to prevent presidents from becoming kings through a case-by-case application of the indeterminate standards, indeterminate standards of their new presidential accountability paradigm," Jackson wrote. "I fear that they are wrong, but for all our sakes, I hope that they are right."
Yep. And what she said, I think, is
indeterminate standards.
We've talked about quite a bit, right? Yeah. Are those indeterminate standards. But, you know, even notwithstanding those standards, again, it feels like it's riddled with booby traps, because even if the standard is met and it's satisfied, that won't be what the court had in mind, or it'll be a really long time before the case is taken up and it's finally resolved and returned back for accountability. And again, whoever says that there will ever be accountability if you end up with, for whatever reason, a president who refuses to leave office and refuses to grant the people the ability to elect a new president. Think of and consider this, and maybe it's more appropriate for our next episode, and I'll elaborate a little more, but of all of the elected offices that we know of and that we enjoy in this thing we call democracy, everything from your street sweeper or dog catcher to your council member, your mayor, your governor, your members of Congress, your members in the Senate, remember that there is only one office in all of the United States of America, only one, where everybody, whether you are in Mississippi or Maine, whether you are in Oklahoma or Ohio, if you are in Connecticut or California, if you are in North Carolina or New Mexico, there's only one office in this entire country where all of us decide. And that is the presidency of the United States of America. We don't have that same say when it comes to everything else, not even for members of Congress or your senators. But the one office we all decide together is the presidency. And what happens if, as a result of this opinion, we don't even have that anymore?
Well, I use the trite phrase, time will tell, but I'm not very encouraged at this point.
And as with Justice Jackson, I hope they are
right. We're wrong.
I hope they are wrong.
I hope we're wrong and they're right, but I have my doubts. Well, I hope you out there as audience understand now the complexity of this, why it's taken us a week to sort through it. And the four buckets that we talked about: absolute immunity, presumptive immunity, unofficial acts with a big, big, huge asterisk next to it that you can only prove if they're manifestly or palpably outside of the role of the presidency, and you can't use any evidence of the official act to prove the unofficial act. That's our show in summary. Judge Gale, as always, thank you. I really appreciate your level-headedness on this, because I got a little off today.
No, I appreciate you being such the scholar and educating all of us on the important tenets of this opinion, because it not only will have sweeping effects in the future, it is currently impacting our lives. And there's nothing more important than being an educated citizen. So thank you all for listening. Please like and subscribe and follow us, because beyond this, we'll have even more great information to share with you.
A reminder, you can subscribe to Next Witness Please on iTunes or at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music's podcasts, Audible, or at the NPR Podcast Directory, or really at any of your favorite podcast outlets. If you have a question or comment about our podcast, you can email it to us at my email address. That's hodson@ohio.edu. hodson@ohio.edu. Next Witness Please is produced through the auspices of WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back very soon to do part two of our analysis of the Trump presidential immunity decision. We'll be looking at the impact of the decision on the four current cases pending against former President Trump. With all that said, Judge Gale, thanks again. Have a good day, everyone.
Thank you, Tom, and take care, everyone.